Good afternoon.
We're ready to start our afternoon session. I know your program says the moderator should be Brian Isaac, but he came down ill this afternoon. And since he's my cousin and I need to preserve the honor of the name, I'll step in and cover for him. In any case, we are now having the session called Science and Technology, Working with Creation, the first session. And we're delighted to have David Larrabee here. He's professor emeritus from East Stroudsburg University in Pennsylvania. And we're delighted to have him here to tell us about climate change. Where do we place our hope?
Thank you.
I guess I've been upgraded. Oops. Good afternoon. So when I talk about climate change, I'm often asked, what gives you hope? The question requires that both the problem and the desired future be identified. Let me turn on my timer. There we go. So, first, I will display some carbon emission profiles that achieve specified temperature rise targets. Second, I'll suggest how to ethically divide the remaining CO2 emissions between countries. Next, I'll examine a fundamental policy assumption that is exacerbating the situation. And finally, I'll close with some reflections on the implications for a life of Christian discipleship. So Miles Allen and his collaborators simulated many different CO2 emission projections. They found that the shape of the emissions curves was less important than the total amount of emissions in predicting the peak temperature rise. The results suggest a rule of thumb. Every trillion metric tons of carbon that you put in the atmosphere causes a peak temperature increase of about 2 degrees Celsius. As a rule of thumb, it has limitations, but I'm more interested in insight than details, although there'll be a lot of details, so I will use the results. This chart summarizes the current situation. This, the total emissions from 1750 to a specific year is plotted on that year. In 1955, when I was born, the total historical emissions, fossil fuels and land use change, totaled 189 billion tons of carbon. In 2017, that total had risen to 631 billion tons. 70% of the total carbon emissions to date have been emitted in my lifetime. This represents 44% of the 1 trillion tons limit for a 2 degree C temperature rise. We are about to pass the 1.5 degree C temperature limit. By 2050, we will pass the 2 degree C temperature limit. And by 2075, we'll be somewhere between a 3 and 4 degree C temperature limit. Time is short. I'm going to consider three historical sources of CO2 emissions: burning fossil fuels and emissions associated with industrial processes, 2, land use changes, and 3, bunker stocks. So bunker stocks are the fuels that are used to travel internationally, aircraft flights, as well as international shipping. In this talk, neither bunker stocks nor land use changes are assigned to individual countries. When we include bunker stocks, since 1750, 656 billion tons of carbon have been put into the atmosphere. This talk is not considering methane or other greenhouse gases, so the stuff I'm going to give you is optimistic. A maximum temperature rise of 1.5 degrees C requires the total accumulated carbon emissions be capped at 750 billion metric tons. Subtract the 656 we've already emitted, and we're only allowed 94 billion metric tons in the budget. At the current emissions rate of 11.5 billion tons a year, we'll use up the remaining budget in less than 8 years. 2 degrees C, 30 years. 3 degrees C, 74 years. Both bunker stocks and land use changes are growing. They need to be reduced to zero. And what follows, I will assume that that both will continue rising to the historic rate for 10 years, level off for 10 years, and then I'll assume that land use change will drop to zero in about 30 years and bunker stocks in 25 years. Subtracting the total remaining contributions of land use change, bunker stocks, and the emissions to date yields an emission budget of how much is available for fossil fuels and industrial emissions to be distributed among the countries. The easy reductions will be accomplished first, and subsequent reductions will get harder and harder. I'm assuming that the emissions will approach an exponential fall off in time, while in the immediate future, they will match the historical slopes. For details of that, please see me afterwards. I'll be happy to do it. Limiting the peak temperature rise to 1.5 degrees C requires a social transformation in 5 years. There's that curve. The outlook of a 2 degrees C temperature, a 100 gigaton limit, looks a little more doable, but still amounts to about 40% of today's emission reduction by 2050. The green and purple curves represent a 3 and 4 degree temperature rise. The decisions we make today have profound implications. So if there's any doubt about the relationship between energy and economics, here's a plot of the gross domestic product versus the energy input for 143 countries on a log-log scale. From small economies to large, from service economies to manufacturing economies, GDP increases, so does the required energy. Globally, about 80% of the energy generations is fossil fuel dependent. Who gets what fossil fuels is a matter of national economic welfare, at least in the short run. So I want to suggest three ethical principles in the division of remaining emissions. One, fairness. Countries with large CO2 emissions per capita should start reductions before countries with lower emissions per capita. If a country has a high emission per capita but a small population, the small population should not excuse them from being among the first to implement a transition to a fossil-free economy. Likewise, a society should not be penalized for having a low emissions per capita, but a large population. Two, justice. Less developed countries should be allowed to continue using fossil fuels to develop to the extent that the global cumulative emissions follows. Why? In the context of the less developed country, that means giving them the means to develop sufficiently to take care of their basic needs and to develop an infrastructure to cope with climate change. Transparency. The method employed should be understandable and publicly available. Without transparency, the method used to allocate resources will always be open to suspicion that the rich are using the method to further their own welfare. The Lorentz curve I'm going to talk about and the Gini coefficient have been used to look at the inequality in CO2 emissions per capita among the world's population at least as far back as 1997. This analysis lends itself naturally to allocation decisions that meet these three criteria. This is a Lorentz curve. A list of countries sorted in order of CO2 emissions per person from lowest to highest. For each country, the population of that country and all previous countries is summed. We call this the cumulative population. Likewise, the emissions for each country and all the previous countries in the list is summed, the cumulative emissions. The Lorentz curve is a plot of the cumulative emissions on the horizontal axis and the cumulative CO2 emissions, the cumulative population on the horizontal axis and the cumulative CO2 emissions on the vertical axis. This is the result. We do this for 213 countries for which we have 2018 data. The dashed straight line will be the result if all the countries had identical emissions per capita. In this case, there would be no inequality in the CO2 emissions. The final value of the endpoint is the total population and the total emissions. Okay. The absolute worst case would be if there was a country with only one person that emitted all the CO2. And that curve would be along the horizontal axis of zero and would rise up in a straight line. So the Gini coefficient is simply the area between these two curves the straight line in the curve divided by the area underneath the diagonal line. Here it's about 50%. To give you an idea, when I use a Gini coefficient for the U.S. income distribution, it's also about 50%. So the world inequality in CO2 emissions is about the same as the inequality in U.S. income. So it's good or bad. So I've identified a few countries on the graph with an arrow. You see the slope of the arrow for the U.S. and China exceed the slope of the great line, saying that the CO2 emissions per capita of those countries is greater than the global average, whereas India, it's a little less. So the moral reading of this chart is that those countries higher on the chart have a moral obligation to take the lead in emissions reductions. That's the fairness criteria. Now, the ethical distribution of reductions follows naturally from here. If we wanted to reduce the emissions in 2018 from about the 9.5 billion tons of fossil fuels to 6, the end result would have to be that straight line. Okay. Any country whose curve is below that line could remain unaffected. Any countries above that line would have to have the emissions reduced so the curve comes up here and follows that red line. Okay. The net result would be the emissions and the inequality would be both reduced. After doing that, for the next year, you'd have to recompute the Lorentz curve because the order of the countries would change. These calculations have been carried out with the aid of a computer program for the emission profiles we've already shown. The future of each emission, of each country, are first projected. Countries whose emissions per capita are increasing continue to increase in a straight line, whose slope matches the weighted historical data. Countries whose emissions are decreasing continue to do so with a declining exponential whose initial slope matches historically weighted data. Each year, the target level of emissions is established, consistent with the profiles I showed earlier. The Lorentz curve is generated, and the country's emissions are trimmed where appropriate. All future per capita emissions of any trimmed country are set to the trim value until some future trimming. In the following year, a new Lorentz curve is generated based on the new data. New trimming proceeds, and this is continued to the year 2100. And if we haven't solved the problem by then, well, this won't matter much. Here is a plot of the emissions per capita for the U.S., China, and India. Notice how the U.S. gets hit first here, and then it falls until it meets about the same per capita emissions as China, which has risen a little bit, and falls until it meets the emissions per capita of India, and they both fall to zero. Okay. But let me show you what happens to a less developed country. I've chosen the Democratic Republic of the Congo, who has had some trials and tribulations, but has been recovering lately. And you can see their emissions in this profile continue to rise, and their trimming doesn't stop till 2085. Now, for a point of comparison, this is about 1% of the U.S. value. So they would argue they need even more, but I would agree. So this shows the implications for the four countries for the four peak temperatures. We've calculated the remaining emissions for each country in terms of the average emissions in 2016 and 17. The U.S. is unlikely to agree to limit its emissions to one more year. So 1.5 degrees C is basically in the bag. Now, okay, we'll get to that in a second. 2 degrees C gives the U.S. about 14 years of emission. China has more time, but they're still developing, so that has to cover not only the development, but also the transition. India has more time, as does the Democratic Republic of the Congo. If the country's emissions continue to rise, these times are even shorter. The U.S. emissions followed if the U.S. emissions followed the global emissions curve for 2 degrees C, I mean, everybody's doing the same amount, the emissions rate in 2015 for the U.S. would have to fall to 38% of the 2018 value. Makes no room for developing countries. Under the proposed situation, the U.S. emissions would have to fall to 11% of the 2018 value in 2050. The ethical choice for the U.S. is to reduce emissions at a rate significantly faster than the global average. So I want to talk about the hidden assumptions. The global total energy consumed globally is steadily increasing at a rate of 180 million tons of oil equivalent per year. Currently, only about 40% of this increase is covered by an increase in hydroelectric or renewable energy sources. Put another way, we are falling behind. What is needed is more time. More time can be obtained by reducing energy consumption, the one option never talked about. Why? Reducing energy consumption in the short term will result in a reduction of GDP, called a recession or even a depression. I'm going to skip that for a bit. This is a plot of the Human Development Index versus the total primary energy supply per country, per capita, for 137 countries for which I have complete data. The Human Development Index is a measure of how well a country provides for the development of its people. Notice the United States here in red is almost two and a half times larger than Denmark here in green, which actually has a higher Human Development Index. And Denmark has 33% of their energy is renewable. Denmark gets about twice as much GDP per unit of energy than the U.S. Comparing U.S. lifestyles with other high Human Development Index countries with lower per capita energy needs could easily be a several-hour lecture. Ethically, the U.S. needs to reduce its energy consumption per capita. So, several times I've been in a Christian conference where dinner was served family style. Took maybe six or eight people around the table. The waiter brings out the main dish, already divided into portions for the table, say eight portions. As a plate is passed around, one or more individual takes two portions. Watching the remaining people navigate the situation, especially as the plate reaches the end, is always a fascinating experience. The amount of fixed carbon that can be placed in the atmosphere makes this a good analogy for the current situation. The U.S. is taking more than its portion. The U.S. lifestyle is desired, but not needed. We do not need 3.5 servings of fossil fuel. We can make do with less. Smaller homes, travel less, modify our purchasing habits, waste less, repair more. Are we willing to change our lifestyle in order to reduce our carbon footprint to make room for the less developed countries to develop? Which is more important to us, our desires or other people's needs? My definition of greed is putting one's desires ahead of somebody else's needs. The hidden assumption in all the analysis you see is that the developed world will not voluntarily lower their lifestyle. Rather, the developed world will use all available means to maintain, if not increase, their material lifestyle. Within the United States, those with a high material lifestyle seem largely unwilling to forgo some of that lifestyle to help others, even within the United States. The American dream suggests that our children have a right to be better off than we are, materially and financially, able to travel more, attend a more prestigious school, earn a larger income. We live in a society that convinces us that these desires, which are limitless, are needs. Simply put, we are greedy. The choice is rather simple. Do we maintain a lifestyle that is destroying the planet and condemning the poorest to poverty? Or do we voluntarily give up that lifestyle to make room for both others and the planet itself? The Bible is filled with injunctions to care for the needy, the stranger, the sick, and the poor. The call to Christian discipleship is not a call to massive wealth, but to a walk with God. I promise I wasn't going to talk about Genesis, but I will talk about Matthew. Matthew 6:24. No one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. Why would we choose to serve money? The simple word is greed. Desire enslaves the rich. The necessity enslaves the poor. And the root cause of both is money. Greed flows from desire. Desperation flows from necessity. Both enslave, both mind and soul. What breaks the bonds of greed? What satisfies the bondage of desperation? The bonds of greed are loosened within a lifestyle of simplicity and service. The bonds of desperation are loosed when the demands of justice are satisfied. To accept the call of Jesus is to refuse the bondage of money. To walk with Jesus is to serve the outcast, the poor, the despised, and the marginalized. To use one privilege for others is absurd, absurd as the cross itself. What is my hope? That we can cast off the shackles of greed. Where do I place my hope? Not in economics, not in politics, not in technology, but in the subversive and transformational power of a walk with Jesus. Thank you.
David was not greedy with his time. He didn't take more than his share, and he gave you time to ask questions. Yes?
Could you, could you talk about some of the bad things that would happen with the one and a half with greedy and receiving?
He says, what are some of the bad things that will happen? I always say are going to happen with 1.5 degrees C. What are some of the bad things that will happen with 1.5 degrees C?
Or two or three.
So at 1.5 degrees C is a level that when you cross that, bad things start happening. And the farther across, the worse things that are going to happen. So one is a temperature increase. Remember, this is a global average. So the simulations so the things that are hotter are going to get hotter. The things that are wetter are going to get wetter. The things that are drier are likely to get drier. It's sort of a general rule of thumb.
Does this correlate somehow to how much coastline we lose?
How much what we lose?
How much of the coastline we lose from the glaciers melting and things like that?
Yeah, so the glaciers are going to melt. Because of the latent heat of the melting, they take a while. So that's not going to be instantaneous, but it is going to be in the long run. So in the long run, you're going to see sea level rise. I lived in Jersey during Sandy. Okay, I can tell you some firsthand some horror stories about Sandy. Florida is already, once it is talking about pumping the waters out of the street, I'm not sure where they're going to put it. But they're trying to pump the waters out of the sea because the streets are already be flooded. Crops are going to have a hard time. You talk to the agricultural people, they're already trying to breed crops that are going to withstand the increased temperatures in the U.S. The science community is doing a lot to try to say, how do we survive this? That's behind the scenes. Given time, you probably could do a lot to help survive the 1.5 and 2 degrees C. But you don't have time. You're not going to move from New York City, even in 50 years. So it is a battle of time, which is one of the reasons why people are talking about carbon sequestration. They're talking about putting aerosols in the atmosphere to reflect light, to seed the ocean, to have the ocean uptake more CO2, which are all sort of acts of desperation.
Thank you.
Yeah. Kind of evangelism and is a one-on-one kind of thing. You can't legislate it. Okay? So when I talk to my friends I'll make the following observation. If I put on a management hat, the prophets in the Old Testament were abysmal failures. Every one of them. Israel did not change the path. They were speaking to the society and saying, this is what you need to. So it's sort of like, here's where we're at, here's what's required, If you don't do it, this is what's going to happen, and if you do it, here's what's possible. That's the role I think Christians can play. Do I expect to be successful long term? Probably not. But our commission is not to force change, our commission is to preach. You know, so I leave it in the hands of God to what's going to happen. My call is to preach. And if I preach and I say what's true, I've satisfied the call.
Okay. Yes. Question over there.
Yeah, David, it almost is like a script from a bad Hollywood movie, right? Asteroid heading to Earth, and everybody on Earth is like, I don't know what to do, I'll just keep doing what I'm doing, and the scientists or the government's going to solve the problem. And that's what it seems when you talk to people. I don't know what to do with it. It'll get solved. And then it's kind of like, the scientists are going to come and save the day.
Right.
But now you're saying all these things are really desperation, mm-hmm. and you don't seem to put much hope in the Calvary coming from the scientists.
I applaud the economists for working. I applaud the politicians for working. I applaud the scientists for what they're trying to do. But I will not put my hope that somehow science is going to come on the white horse and save everything. I should say, I started off in fusion energy in 1980, when fusion energy, 25 years from then, was going to save the world from the energy crisis.
If only.
Right. So now it's maybe 30 years away. We've actually lost ground. We will always put more energy. You satisfy this? We'll want more. Gentlemen in the back,
I think. Yeah, I noticed, and I may have misinterpreted those graphs, but it looked like to ameliorate this, we have to go down to zero emissions of fossil fuels somehow.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, zero emissions.
Yes.
What happens to people who are trying to survive without fossil fuels? So my question is, it's one thing to say our hope is in the Lord, it most certainly is, but how do we get to that? I mean, And a corollary question is, what do you feel about nuclear fission as a way to be a method of generating energy that does not produce primarily CO2? I mean, you produce some in the building of the thing, right? But basically, it is essentially an emissionless technology that way.
Which is good for perhaps a short term. And currently, it takes 10 years to site and build a plant, in fact. And if I have 8 years to 2 degrees C, 10 years of plan is not going to help me.
One of the issues there is regulatory. I mean, that's really the main issue with the time is the regulations. And I think it's been so unwieldy that essentially anybody can sue you when you can't build the plant.
There are environmentalists that are now pro nuclear power, but I said it's a.
We'll take one more because we're coming close to the end, please. Okay.
So, two things. First of all, it's really important that we as Christians get really engaged in this. People that are doing the research on climate change, they want us involved. They want that to be a part of what's going on. Second thing, here's how we solve it. Anybody that sells gasoline has to put 3% of that investment into the capital of sustainable energy. Wind, solar, whatever. 10 years, they've worked themselves out of gasoline, and they're all solar and wind companies.
I think you're optimistic. And I will say that so the economists would tell you that the price elasticity of gasoline is such that you could increase it 50% more, and you're not going to make massive
extraction of money.
It's the money that you want.
You get both. That was a quick one, so one more. Okay. You're doing something else.
I was just going to comment that when I see the God and money thing, I'm thinking it's going to cost a lot of money. So that, I think he's right. We need to get money from somewhere to do it.
Yeah.
I can't run out and get a Tesla right now.
Right, but every watt you don't. So if I cut the energy consumption in half, the amount of energy produced by renewable resources would be percentage-wise, would be even double.
Okay.
It's a lot easier not to consume it than it is to produce more of it.
Okay, we need to move on. Thank you very much.